2 Samuel 13. The home, because of its close relationships, the closest relationships which you will have on earth, these relationships in the home mean that the home can be a place of either the greatest happiness and enjoyment. It's the place that you can experience the fruit of righteousness, and it can be a bit of heaven on earth. Or the home can be the opposite. Because of those close relationships and because of the intimate nature of the relationships in the home, it can be also the place of greatest tension. You think that problems at work can be bad. Problems in the home are far greater. Well, problems in the home are the worst kind of problems because of the relationships within the family structure. So it can be the place of greatest blessing or greatest cursing. And I'm sad to say that in David's home life, it became a place where there was not great blessing. It became a place of great cursing. We are in the midst of the fall of David's family, part 2. Tonight, in chapter 13, beginning at verse 23, the roots of rebellion, or how to produce a rebellious son or daughter, as the case may be. In David's case, it was the production of a rebellious son. We're going to resume our study in verse 23 and the case of the revenge of Absalom and the restoration of Absalom to the king's favor and to his father's favor. Let's pray. Let's commit our time to the Lord as we study this passage. Father, we look to you to teach us by your Holy Spirit. Thank you for that anointing that is ours in Christ, that the Spirit gives us, that now we stand in need of insight as we study this passage line upon line. Father, this affects us all, for we're parents, we'll be grandparents, we have opportunity to minister to parents who are going through or who have gone through the tensions of rebellion in the home. So teach us as to what produces this and how your Spirit can remedy that. In Christ's name we ask it. Amen. Here's the situation. The life of David, you know, comes into its second part when we come to 2 Samuel. The life of David comes into that period of his life where he experiences the apex of his prosperity. Beginning in 2 Samuel, you have David peaking in terms of spiritual, physical, monetary prosperity. But when we come to the 11th chapter, we make a definite turn in David's prosperity. He loses his prosperity in measure. He loses it because of sin. There was a great fall. The fall was, of course, that of adultery and then murder. Chapter 12 is the account of David's recovery from this fall, and chapter 13 is the beginning of the account of the repercussions from David's fall. David's sin, like any sin, has a cause and effect principle tied in with it. Sin always has certain effects, a ripple effect. The ripple effect of sin goes all the way down through human history. Every sin that you and I commit has a ripple effect that will go on down until the Lord makes all things new. Certainly Adam's sin did, didn't it? And all of our problems and our Adamic nature and all that's capable of his testimony, the ripple effects of sin. So like Adam, our sin has a ripple effect. We're seeing that ripple effect beginning to take place, and we can learn something from it. Hopefully what we'll learn is that when we do sin, that we realize the tremendous consequences that are involved in sin, the tremendous price that sin demands. So let's Let's look in the 13th chapter in 23 now. This is the second phase of the chaos in the home. The first was chapters 13, 1 to 22. Amnon's lust. Amnon, son of David, was attracted to Tamar. Tamar was Amnon's half-sister. Amnon lusted after her. He could not have her sexually or as his wife. The law forbade him marrying her. It was frustrating to Amnon to not be able to fulfill his lust. He raped his half-sister, Tamar. As a result of that rape, his brother, half-brother Absalom, becomes livid with anger. We find in verse 22 that Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or bad. For Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. Now that takes us into the next ripple effect of David's sin. You see it affecting his family. Now we've seen it affect Amnon. Now we see how it affects Absalom, and that's going to occupy our attention down through 15, 16 of 2 Samuel. So what we'll be studying tonight is the subject of the root of rebellion, or the roots of rebellion. Many homes I have had to counsel with people in this church, out of this church, all my time of ministry. As far back as I can remember, one of the first kinds of crises that I had to face and that I had to provide some kind of help to parents for was in the matter of a rebellious son or a daughter. A rebellious teenager. Many a home has been torn apart by that crisis, which we know is, well, it's just literally insurrection. It is a revolution in the home. Many parents have wondered when they end up with a rebellious son or a daughter, what went wrong? What did I do? What can we do? We've got a daughter that won't listen to us. She's doing as she pleases. She's coming and going as she pleases. I recall talking to a family a few years ago. They were actually prisoners in their own home. The father called me and was describing what has transpired with their teenage daughter. And after he got through describing all of the complications that were coming into their family life because of this rebellious daughter, they were actually prisoners in their own home. They were miserable. How does one view rebellion in the home? Who's at fault? What produces that crisis where a son, for instance, will rise up in defiance of the parents and want to leave home, or if they don't leave home, they start actually challenging the parental authority day after day? Exactly how are parents to view the dynamics of rebellion? Now, for those of us who have children who are coming along in years, we naturally have the question, will we ever be the victims or participants in a crisis of rebellion in our home? Will you have a rebellious son or daughter that will literally tear your heart apart because of their act of rebellion? Will you? You say, no, I'm doing things as best as I know how, and I think I'm doing things fairly well. I know I'm not perfect, but I think I've really minimized those chances of having a rebellious son or daughter. But if you were going to be absolutely candid about it, you would have to admit that it is always possible to have a rebellious son or a daughter. David had his shortcomings, but mind you, David also was a man after God's own heart. If King David could have a rebellious family like he did, particularly in Absalom, David, the sweet singer of Israel, who penned those mighty psalms, a man who had his theology, a man who knew the Lord, if he could have a rebellious son, we can have a rebellious son or daughter. Now that doesn't mean that it's going to happen to you like some kind of curse. It is that you will have a rebellious son or a daughter regardless of what you do, if that's in the cards, so to speak. No, I think there are things that you can do to head that off. And there are, well, may I recommend that you go back to last week's message, because that message is a partner with what we're going to study tonight. Now let's look at Absalom, and then I want us to go through at the very conclusion of this study of Absalom and his rebellion against David. I want us to see the four stages in rebellion against authority. When a teenager rebels against their parents, there are four stages, and they are found in Absalom's rebellion against his father. You see if you can detect them as we go through the end of this chapter and into the 14th chapter, and hopefully that by David's example we will learn something. And for those of us that are responsible for children, or who will to some degree be responsible to our children's children, that we have here an example of a man who contributed to the rebellion of his own son, a father who helped to make a rebellious son. How can we avoid that? Let's look at Absalom, see what he did. Now it came about after 2 full years that Absalom, this is 2 Samuel 13:23. It came about that after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. Now there is a method in Absalom's mind here. He's not out to just bring together the family for a nice little camaraderie with all the boys. That Absalom for 2 years has been nursing a grudge. That Absalom has planned from the very day that he heard what Amnon did to his sister. He has been planning the proper time, the right place and the right time to get his revenge against Amnon. Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold, now your servant has sheep shears. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant." Now, it's interesting that David's sins here come back to haunt him, because Absalom is doing the very thing with David that David sought to do with regard to Uriah, didn't he? But what Absalom is doing here, he's using his father. And David is unaware that Absalom is trying to contrive the situation so that he can easily kill Amnon. David is being used by his son, like David used his trusted soldier, Uriah, to bring death on Uriah. So David, after this is all done, must have thought back on how, at least it's brought home to him, what he brought to pass in another man's life. He's had to experience it himself. So here is Absalom. He's very shrewd. Absalom was smart. He was no dummy. You have to say this about David's children. They were all seemed to be very intelligent, very good looking. They had a lot going for them in terms of physical attributes. But shrewdness is not the ultimate virtue. Though they may have been smart, yet they were smart to the point of their own demise. His rudeness contributed to his downfall. Absalom said, I'm not going through all of the verses here. Absalom simply goes to David to try to get all the boys up there where he is. Verse 30, it was while they were on the way that the report came to David saying, Absalom has struck down all the king's sons and not one of them is left. Rumors do have a way of getting out of hand, don't they? And rather than what's happened here is that not that by the time it gets back to David, though only Amnon has been killed, it seems like all of his sons have been killed. Well, that just tears David's heart right out. He cannot take that kind of news. The king rose, he tore his clothes, he lay on the ground, and all of his servants were standing by with clothes torn. And then Jonadab came along, and the son of Shimei, David's brother, and he responded. And he gives the proper news about the situation. He says, for Amnon alone is dead. because by the intent of Absalom, this has been determined since the day that he violated his sister Tamar. Now David finds out. David, Absalom has killed Amnon, and he's been planning on it for 2 years. Before I go any further, I want you to notice that one of the reasons for Amnon's failure here, or Absalom's failure in killing Amnon, taking things into his own hand, matters into his own hands, David should have done something about Amnon's sin. What did David do? He got mad. Just like a lot of us parents do at times with our own children, you may get angry because they frustrated you. But mere anger in itself is not going to correct a child, is not going to correct the situation. Now there is sinful and non-sinful anger. What kind did David have? Did he have righteous indignation? I don't know. It seems like from the context that he was thoroughly put out with his son, but yet he was acting, his relationship with his son was more of sentimentality rather than righteousness. And rather than do justice with regard to his son and bring him to discipline, David didn't do anything, and so Absalom took things into his own hands, and then Absalom becomes guilty of murder. So David has a part in this. He contributes to Absalom's fall. And we notice that Absalom fled after this. David fails again. He doesn't do anything to Absalom when Absalom kills Amnon. This is the characteristic of David from here on out. He's half-hearted. He won't really go on and do what he's supposed to. He won't take the bull by the horns. He gives half-heartedness to every decision. And when you make half decisions, you create all kinds of problems when you know that you're to do the right thing and you don't do it. Look what David's done. He did not discipline Amnon. And so what happens? Absalom comes along, takes things in his own hand, kills Amnon. He doesn't discipline Absalom. What happens? Absalom goes out for 2 years, and weeds of bitterness grow up in Absalom's heart, and he becomes rebellious. That's how to grow a rebellious son or daughter. Don't deal with sin when it comes up. Just overlook it as a parent. Well, I'm coming back to that. But you see what happened. Absalom fled, verse 37, and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom goes to his mother's kingdom. David is, I think, demonstrating his weakness here again. He lets Absalom flee, does nothing. He longs for Absalom. Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the heart of King David longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. I think the point here is that he grieved over Amnon's death. But after a while, he began to make the adjustments to life, and he recovered from the grief, and he wanted to go out to Absalom. So he's ambivalent here about what he should do. On the one hand, here is the discipline that should have been meted out to Absalom. But on the other, he's his son. And he doesn't want to lose his son. So he doesn't do anything. Absalom stays away for 3 years. Joab comes back into the picture. Joab is always lurking in the wings. Joab is a man who's very shrewd. Joab is a man who's looking out for Joab. He appears to be very loyal, and in some ways he is, but Joab is looking out for his own political future. I think that's exactly why he goes into this plot. And he gets this wise woman from his town, well, near his town. He goes to a place called Tekoa. This is the hometown of Amos. It's down near the Dead Sea area. It's 5 miles south of Bethlehem. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived or knew that the king's heart was inclined toward Absalom. That is, he longed for him. So Joab works on a plot. I think there were probably a couple of motivations behind Joab's plot here to get David back with Absalom. I think that David's disposition was absolutely downcast. I think it was affecting his administrative ability. Joab saw that this could very well be he was undermining the kingdom. He was not exuding confidence before the people. He was so depressed. You cannot function properly when you're depressed and you're not meeting the problems of the day as they come up. You're wallowing in your own self-pity and you're blue. So Joab saw what was happening. Things were falling apart. I think, too, Joab realized that what side his bread was buttered on. Because as you go down the line, Amnon's dead. Absalom is the next in line for kingship. This puts Joab third down the line, being commander-in-chief behind David. And so he put him third in line. And if Absalom comes into power, well, Joab would be second in command then, moving right up the ladder. So I think Joab is thinking along those lines, and he's trying to get Absalom and David back together again. So here's his plot, and it gets quite intricate through here, in beginning in verse 2 all the way down to verse 20. I'm not going to go through every verse. There are a few that I'd like to nest on for a little bit, but I want to show you. Let me give you basically the plot. This is the way it worked. He finds this very wise woman from this town of Tekoa, and he says, now listen, I want you to go to the king. I want you to tell him this story. Here's the story. We can read it. What's your trouble? He said, lady. She's all wrought up. She prostrates herself on the ground. Oh, king, help me. David, being the emotional man that he is, he immediately identifies somebody who's distraught. He said, what's your trouble? She answered, I'm a widow. My husband is dead. Your maidservant has two sons. But the two of them struggled together in the field. And there was no one to separate them, so one struck the other and killed him. Now what's the... Hey, has this method ever been used on David before? Apparently, everybody, word was around that David has a weakness for stories. This is the same tactic that Nathan used on David to elicit David's self-confession, his confession of guilt. Because what he's told this woman to do is to tell this story. It's a parable. What, right away, David being the emotional fellow that he is, he gets right into the story. Right into this, well, he thinks it's all really come about. So David gets right into it, and he becomes favorably disposed toward the culprit here, the villain. Now, of course, in the other story, he became favorably disposed toward whom? The victim. And he said, hey, let's find out who did that. Now he's favorably disposed to the culprit. How? The whole family has risen up against your maidservant, and they say, hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. And destroy the heir also. That's the key phrase here. That's what gets David to identify with her. That's where David feels real empathy for. Kill the heir? Is there anything in that story that David would have been particularly sensitive about? Sure, because he's seen Amnon killed, and Absalom's away from him. The king's thought about heirship. So he can identify with this woman when your heir is, their life is on the line, because that's the way Absalom is right then. Thus they will extinguish my coal, which is left, that's her surviving son, as so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Now, that's kind of an allusion to Absalom here. At least David is probably, oh, yeah, I know what you mean, lady. Right. And she's persistent. The king said, he seems like he tries to get out of it a little bit. He wants to buy a little time. Go to your house. I'll give some orders concerning you. I'll send on the word later. I'll take care of it, okay? She's persistent. She's not through. Look, she says, O my lord, the king, the iniquity is on thee. In my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. She's persistent with it. All right, he said. All right, whoever speaks to you, bring them along. Bring your accusers. I'll take care of it. So she said, please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy, lest they destroy my son. He said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. He guaranteed the safety of her son, who had committed this crime, at the expense of justice. See what he's done? And this parable shows where David has developed a real blind spot. The dynamics of it are quite interesting. When David committed his sin with Bathsheba and then had Uriah killed in the great cover-up, That Watergate in David's life seems to be something that's always standing in the back of his mind, and he seems to let it affect his decisions. He seems to now be more subjective about things. He's not objective about things at all. He's not rendering decisions based upon rules and righteousness. He is making decisions based on his feelings. And that's why he's going to reap the whirlwind with his son here. He's making decisions based upon emotion. He is in total subjectivity. He has surrendered justice for the sake of what? Just to calm this lady down and to help this boy. He's just been emotionally involved. He set a trap for himself because of his lack of discernment. The woman said, Why then have you planned such a thing against the people? She's going to apply her parable now. For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring back his banished one. Who is that? Absalom. See what she's making, the point she's making now? She's saying, you, David, have wronged Israel. You, David, you, the king, look what you're doing to your son Absalom, your only heir. For, look at verse 14, we shall surely die and are like water spill out on the ground which cannot be gathered up. Yet God does not take away life but plans ways so that the banished one, that's Absalom, may not be cast out from him or remain estranged. What is she saying here? She is suggesting that delay is going to be unsafe and dangerous. Don't delay. We've got to do something. And this is the real kicker. This is the point that came across to David. God showed mercy to you, David, didn't he? Did David deserve to die because of his adultery and murder? He did. God showed him mercy, and he didn't die. Now, he is being counseled to show mercy. You know who was really saying this to David? Not this woman, but Joab. These were words that he put into her mouth. And he picks up something that David had said. You can see it. Look back in chapter 11. I'll show it to you in verse 25. This shows you Joab had it all worked out in his mind, because when he had to deliver that note, look in verse 25, chapter 11, then David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you. What thing? That the death of Uriah, putting him right up there in the front line and then withdrawing the troops and he gets killed. For the sword devours one as well as another. What did he tell Joab? He said, Joab, don't worry about it. Everybody's got to die sometime. What a heartless thing to say. Now, what does Joab do? Joab picks up that statement, coaches this lady, and she says to David, listen, we're all going to die, David. Are you going to put off reconciliation with Absalom and then he die? And he die without reconciliation ever taking place? Why don't you show mercy? Well, what does David do? Well, the story moves along, and the king said, okay, verse 19, is the hand of Joab with you in all this? What had tipped him off? I guess some things he knew about Joab and what Joab knew about him. And so he says, then the king said, verse 21, to Joab, behold, now I will surely do this thing. Go therefore, bring back the young man Absalom. Now, in verses 21 to 33, Absalom comes back. And but look what David has him. This boy's been out, and he comes back, and David said, the king said, let him turn to his own house, verse 24, and let him not see my face. He's unwilling to forgive. Here's some more of that half-heartedness on David's part. See it again? He didn't discipline Amnon. He didn't discipline Absalom. And then when Absalom comes back, does he forgive him? Halfway. want to see. You come on back to the house, but I don't want to see you around here. I mean, you go out your door, and you, if somebody did that, you'd think, what kind of forgiveness is that? But I have known people who put those kinds of contingencies on their relationships, husband and wife. Yeah, I'll stay with you as long as you don't get in my way. What kind of contingency is that? This is what David's saying. Half-heartedness. It's just characteristic of David from on out now. What's happened to this man? He's not making objective judgments anymore. This is not right. No. Did God forgive David like that? Did God say to David, David, I forgive you, but get out of my sight. You read Psalm 51 and you see how God forgave David. David's not acting in character here at all. It's tragic. There's a little parenthesis here about Absalom because it tips us off to something that's going to be happening later on. Shows us a little bit about Absalom's personality. In all Israel, there was no one as handsome as Absalom. So highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. Mr. America. I mean, he must have quite a lock of hair. It says so in verse 26. When he cut the hair of his head, it was at the end of every year that he cut it. And it was heavy on him, so that when he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. Now, the best we can determine, that comes out to around 4 pounds. Now, that's a pile of hair. You cut somebody's, if you let your hair go a year and get a haircut, is it going to come out to 4 pounds? Anybody want to try it this next year? Well, anyway, the point is that Absalom, he must have been a real golden boy. He was good looking. He was smart. By the way, may I make a few comments about something here? Do you notice something that's true of the sons of Jesse, David, his brothers, and David's children? Do you notice something about this family? They had a lot of good-looking people in the family. You notice that? Let me say something about that. Let me draw your attention to who all in this in the family of David. Now, David, Bathsheba's not related to them, only by marriage, but she was a good-looker. It says so. She was beautiful. David was a good-looker. He was a nice-looking man. One of the first things said about him, beautiful complexion, just nice features, just put together real well, athletic, smart, everything. Absalom was a good looker and was smart and apparently very athletic. Tamar, the half-sister of Amnon, she was good-looking. And the daughter of Absalom, whom he named Tamar, she is said to have been good-looking. There must have been some interesting genes that ran through that family. They had a lot of nice-looking people in the family. Let me give you three quick things about good looks. Number one, they're a gift from God. If you got good looks, now, if you're in any doubt whether you got good looks or not, don't be asking anybody. Go to the mirror, make your own judgment, and be quiet about it. Somebody along the line somewhere has probably said you're cute. Some old girlfriend or something. Maybe you ladies have to go back that far. Some old boyfriend said that you were nice looking. You can't remember when your husband said that, but somewhere along the line, somebody has said that you look nice. Got a nice nose or like the hair, beautiful figure, something. But just remember this. Every feature is a gift from God. We can't take credit for that. Now, the world really blows this thing out of proportion. It's nothing really that a person earns. It's something that you either have or you don't have. It's given by God. Another factor is that it's the occasion for special temptations. If you have a measure of attractiveness and good looks, just remember that there's a price, and that means extra temptation. There are special temptations and problems associated with good looks. Three, inner beauty is more important than outer beauty. Look at the losers here. Yeah, David was nice looking, but he fell. Bathsheba was beautiful, but she was conniving. She fell. Absalom was handsome. But you know how he ended up wrapping his hair around a branch of a tree and he hangs himself. Inner beauty and character is far more important than outer features. Always. Now we always have to remember that, lest in our preening process, and we all do our preening, clothes, hair, ladies, makeup, there's nothing wrong with these things. There's nothing wrong with preening, as long as it's kept in context. Are you more concerned about what you are, your character, than what you want to appear to be physically? Well, that's so much. That's just a parenthesis. No extra charge on that, because couldn't get by though with all that hair weighing 4 pounds and him being such a handsome man. We had to say something about that. Well, so much for Absalom. But wait a minute, he had 3 sons. Oh, now that's going to be a tragedy. All 3 of his sons are going to die before he dies. But Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. But finally, he can't take this exclusion any longer. He's been shut off in his room. Dad said, I don't want to see your face in the... I want to meet you at the dinner table. Eat your meal some other time. So what does Absalom do to get David's or his attention? He works through Joab. He has this plot. His field is right next to Joab's field. So what does he do? Well, I know how to get Joab's attention. I'll burn his field. Well, get the fire department out here. They get a lot of, just get a lot of publicity going. Joab rose. He said, all right, I've had it. See, he tried to get Joab to come around. He wouldn't do it. So he burns his field. Says, okay, you win, Absalom. What do you want? He came to Absalom in his house and said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent for you, say, I'm here, that I may send you to the king and say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me still to be there. I have been here, 2 years? Now, he had been in exile for 3, and now 2, and David is still not speaking to him. That's awful. Well, we humans, we can bear things and nurse them and carry them on. And well, this half-hearted reconciliation is just unbearable. He can't take it. Don't blame him. Joab came to the king and told him, call for Absalom. Came to the king, prostrated himself, his face on the ground before the king. The king kissed Absalom. I wish that I could give you that as a, hey, they all lived happily ever after. This is great. But you know what that becomes? That just becomes a stepping stone for another tragedy, the greatest tragedy. And now I've got to come back and put some things together for you here. That's the story. Did you get these cycles, these stages, rather, of rebellion? You see a rebellious son here. You won't actually see his full-blown rebellion till next Wednesday when we get into the 15th chapter. That's where it will really come off. This, the lid blows right up. But you're seeing something in chapters 13 and 14 about what produced this rebellion. You're getting that. Now let me go through again this account with just a few principles about Absalom and David. Then I want to give you those 4 principles or those 4 stages in the production of a rebellious son or daughter. Let me give you let's go through the narrative again quick. All right, number 1, Absalom chose to disobey the law of God. We want to start with that. Be sure to get this down. Absalom is responsible for his sin. This is what I'm saying. I have said that David was wrong. David contributed to Absalom's fall. David gave a poor example before Absalom. But I want to start off with this point. Absalom was responsible for his sinful decisions. Absalom chose to disobey God. Parents, principle. When your children disobey God, they choose to disobey God. They are responsible for disobeying God. And they will answer for it. Now that's not to take you and me off the hook for our failures, what we may have contributed to their fall. But in the final analysis, your children, my children, are responsible for their decisions. Absalom defied the law of God. He killed his brother. And he's about to start a conspiracy to overthrow David as well. The second factor is this. David contributed to Absalom's revenge and rebellion. Now we get back to the father, and this is where the shoes start getting tight, Dad. They really get tight here, because David contributed to Absalom's rebellion and revenge. How? Let me show you at least four ways in which David contributed to Absalom's revenge and rebellion. Number one, his failure to establish a family structure. He multiplied wives. David was to have had only one wife, but he didn't, in defiance of the law of God. Two, because of his adultery and murder, he violated the standards of God with regard to sex. He committed adultery. Three, he failed to discipline Amnon. After Amnon had raped his half-sister, David didn't do a thing to Amnon. He failed to discipline one of the other children. Four, he failed to deal with Absalom consistently. Number one, he didn't discipline Absalom when he should have. When Absalom killed his brother, David didn't do a thing. Absalom ran off, David didn't pursue it, just let it go. And he didn't completely forgive Absalom either, did he? Once Absalom had come back, David said, "All right, you can come back, but I don't want to see you." Half-hearted forgiveness. There was not reconciliation. All right, so David contributed to Absalom's rebellion. Three, David's relationship with Absalom was based on emotion rather than genuine love. David's relationship with Absalom was based on emotion rather than genuine love. And parents, here's how we may fail our children. Because we become sentimental in our relationships with them rather than showing them genuine love. Genuine love looks out for their well-being, providing what's necessary for them, what their needs are, sacrificing ourselves for those needs. Sentimentality is just giving them what they want. It's the ice cream and cake approach. Just whatever makes them happy, we do for them. That is apparently the way David is trying to build a relationship with his children. He doesn't want to do anything that's really going to hurt the relationship. But he does, though, doesn't he? That's the deception about this sentimental method of relating to your children. You're so worried about whether your children are going to like you or not that you end up doing the very thing that will guarantee they won't like you by not giving them genuine love, which involves discipline. Thirdly, then, David's relationship with Absalom was based on emotion rather than righteousness, rather than genuine love. He lost his objectivity with his children. Four, Absalom's personality and abilities became the occasion for rebellion, for the occasion for a way in which the rebellion manifested itself. Now, I didn't say this was the cause. Absalom's ability and personality did not become is not the reason. I mean, the fact that he was good-looking, that he was smart, all of this, he was next in line for the throne, that was not the reason for his sin. But it did become the occasion. The point I'm trying to get at is this. Though Absalom was smart, and though Absalom was good-looking, that his rebellion took the form of political conspiracy, ultimately. Where does a good-looking, smart fellow go who knows how to get people behind him? Often he'll go into politics. I'm not saying all politics are good-looking and smart, but I'm saying that quite often people who know how to win other people, they will go off and lead people. But Absalom's rebellion showed itself in a political conspiracy. You take in another home, a child's rebellion may take the... what form could it take? May take drugs with one child. Another child wouldn't be drugs at all. Another child, their rebellion will take the form of drink. Take another kid, they don't want to fool with the chemicals, and their rebellion will be sex. Another kid might not be interested in that. Their rebellion will just be meanness. Just downright meanness toward everybody. Well, you can go on and on. What I'm getting at is that the way the rebellion will manifest itself will probably be through the personality of the child. So you might think that one is being more rebellious, but rebellion is rebellion. It is as witchcraft, we're told in 1 Samuel. That's how awful it is. Five, David's failure to forgive Absalom became the occasion for Absalom's bitterness. David's failure to forgive Absalom became the occasion for Absalom's bitterness. Do you know what I think we have an illustration of here? Listen to these verses. Colossians 3:21. Fathers, don't irritate your children or they may become exasperated. You think Absalom got exasperated? I sure do. Here's another one. Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, don't provoke your children to anger, but rather bring them up with the Lord's discipline and counsel. I think we have a negative illustration of that in David and Absalom. David failed Absalom. So David's failure to forgive Absalom became the occasion for Absalom's bitterness. Now, all that to get to this. What are these four stages in the development of rebellion? Now, I know I'm not giving you a lot of solutions tonight. That was last week. So if you didn't get last week's message, I know this probably seems a little uneven. That, hey, you're telling us all these problems. Say, yes, I know somebody's got a rebellious son or daughter. What do they do about it? Last week. Now we get what brings it about. And this has value, though. This is a solution in that you can see the stages and you can stop it with your own children. Grandparents, and to the extent that you have ministry to your children and grandchildren, you can stop it. All right? Let me show you how the stages of rebellion work. That 14 or 15 or 16-year-old teenager that all of a sudden starts their own revolution in the home and becomes completely uncontrollable, that doesn't just start. All right, here's how it works. Number one, stage one is internal resistance to some aspect of the moral will of God. That's where it starts. Let's draw it. There is, in stage one, there is this internal resistance to some aspect of the moral will of God. What was it in Absalom's case? Well, the record only takes us to one event. There may have been other things. But what does the record take us to? His grudge against his brother. I'm going to kill Amnon. I'm just going to be cool, quiet. I'm going to get him, though. And he nursed that grudge for 2 years. He, in doing that, was resisting, rebelling against the moral law of God. And I believe he knew it. But he didn't care. It may be this son or daughter sees that there is some internal or there is some preferential treatment with another son or daughter in the home. Maybe it does exist. The mother or father inadvertently or maliciously are showing preferential treatment to another child. And so that child then will resist the will of God in their life in some area. It may be with any number of other things, clothing, hair, music, date life, duties around the house, friends, church. This often becomes the occasion. Someday the child says, well, I don't want to go to church. What will a parent do? The teenager's got to realize that they, if they resist the moral will of God. You say, well, how can you say that clothes or music or going to church is the moral will of God? There's no verse in the Bible on it. I'll tell you this, that what the parent says, as long as they're not requesting the child to commit an act of immorality, as long as they don't ask the child to lie, cheat, steal, or whatever else, that is the will of God for the child. That is God speaking in principle. So for the child to rebel against the parent in this internal rebellion, that is the first stage where they resist some aspect of the moral will of God. And I put in a little parenthesis. Therefore, parents, one of the things that you and I must do, one of the basic in preventing this rebellion against the moral will of God and preventing a rebellious son or daughter, is to teach them explicit obedience at the very earliest age. I mean, as soon as they're able to reach out that little nubby hand, they can put that soft little chubby hand out to grab something and say, no! I mean that early. When you're tempted to think it's cute and the child is an entertainment for aunts and uncles and everybody, oh, isn't it cute? And that child, though, on those very, very earliest stages, they're being taught something. See, because to that child, those parents are as God. They cannot think in abstracts. They think in concrete forms. There's mother and dad, they say yes, they say no. At the very earliest age, they must be taught the importance of explicit obedience. Now, instruction goes along with it as their vocabulary develops, but they must be taught. Teach them God's character. Teach them to, and let these truths live, work out in your own life. Seek to be consistent. But teach them with instruction, discipline them with instruction. Teach them the importance of obedience, because their response to you will be their response to God. And if you let them get away with it, second, third, and fourth time, you know what they'll be wanting to do with God? That second, third, and fourth time. And God doesn't work that way. Well, that's beside the point in a way. That's a parenthesis. Let's go back to the second stage. Our first stage is internal resistance to some aspect of the moral will of God. Second stage is communication breakdown. Communication breakdown is father, mother. This is silence at the dinner table. Chapter 14, verse 24, there it is. He said, let him not see my face. That's the idea. Now, this is a symptom of the rebellion. This isn't the rebellion, but it does become a part of the problem. Communication breakdown. Often parents really blow it when this communication breakdown comes in. Slamming of doors, silence at the table. What's the wrong response to that? The wrong response is to overlook it and say, oh, it's just temporary. They'll get over it. They'll sleep it off. Oh. Well, let the sun go down on your wrath. You better get that point across to your children. They better not let the sun go down on their wrath. You might think you'll just soon forget it. And so you just, well, let's overlook it. The right response, however, is doing what? The right response is you deal with it immediately. You don't allow it to go any further. You stop. Stop your meal. Everything. Hold it. The show stops. Nothing is more important. This program on TV, this roast beef, this dessert, the company that's here, whatever. We got to stop this. That shows the urgency of it, of the issue. So that's the way you deal with this communication breakdown. You move in on it right there. But if you allow the child to go on, unwilling to communicate and sulking and withdrawing, it becomes a habit pattern. And it goes right on, gets worse every time. You've got to deal with it immediately. Okay, that's the second stage. There is this communication breakdown wherein the child, son or daughter, will not, a barrier is built up. There is this resistance to some aspect of the moral will of God, then the communication breakdown, and then thirdly, parental rebellion. Right? Parental rebellion. See, I'm giving you the four stages of rebellion. We haven't gotten to the peak yet. But parental rebellion. This is the failure of the parents to biblically respond to the initial rebellion. And this is where parents create a lot of their problems, right here. You see it in David's case. What did David do with a rebellious son in the making? You know what he did? He put in more ingredients to make him more rebellious. And that's what we parents have a tendency to do. That is why parents end up becoming prisoners in their own homes, is because they feed the fire. As it were, they create the monster. They get the monster started and they feed it. Here's how. Some examples. How does parental rebellion work? How do parents fail to respond to this rebellion that they see in their son or daughter? Well, one way is they can just minimize or ignore the situation. Just forget it. Just get out of the house or, you know, just forget it. Read the paper. Just kind of let things just die out. Another way in which they can show their own rebellion is that they can start comparing their own past with the child. They can say, when we were your age, no. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a place for using your past as a means of instruction, but what I'm saying is that if you are only using your past as a club, it won't work. You get what I mean? if they're rebelling against God, and what you're trying to do is just beat them down with what you were, what you did or didn't do, that's not enough. Or try to buy the rebellious son or daughter. Try to buy them off. Coax them to obey. New car, clothes, trip, some goodie. Try to buy them off. You know, some parents actually become so afraid of their own children, they do try, they keep buying them off. Or some parents go to the other extreme, tighter regulations. They try the prison approach. And they just come down with all kinds of enormous rules. Oh, just completely overboard. And they want to set up a prison. I'm not saying there isn't a place for discipline, obviously. But if it's only the prison approach without the other factors, it's going to backfire on you. You're going to get a more rebellious son or daughter. Or you can just accept the rebellion and live with it and condone it. I've known parents who've done that. They just accept it. They live. They let the child just start talking back to them any way they please. They let them get away. Rather than cause a big ruckus, they just say, well, we'll just let it go. I'm not getting beat up here or anything. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And so they just live and let live. But in the process, they're asking for the final coup d'etat. Because we haven't really gotten to the breaker yet. That's the fourth stage. And that's increasing social maladjustment. We come back to the rebellious son or daughter. Increasing social maladjustment. What happened here with Absalom? David finally did something, didn't he? Come on back, but I don't see your face. So what does Absalom do? He burns down his next door neighbor's field to get his dad's attention. And that's what will happen. Your son or your daughter might, as it were, burn somebody's field down to get your attention. In the following ways. By picking out the crummiest friends they can pick out. Real clods. Because they know that you will react to that. They want to get a reaction out of you. So they pick out clods. Potheads or anything down that line, and they bring them around, and this is who they start moving with. Or they start refusing to study. They're going to make all kinds of poor grades in school. Or sex, drink, drugs, combination, maybe all. But what they begin to do then is challenge authority outside the home. Wasn't that what Absalom was doing? Exactly. He was challenging authority outside the home to get attention in the home. They'll start challenging authority at school. They'll challenge authority if they attend a church. They'll become a church brat, if the church allows it to go on. They'll challenge authority if they work. They can't hold a job down. They'll challenge authority that officer stops them with a blue light on top of his car. And then he stops them for speeding, and then what do? They start mouthing off. Or they try to outrun him. Or a combination of drink and speed, and they try to outrun the police, and they end up head on with an oak tree, and the tree doesn't give. They do. Social maladjustment. See, we're coming to that with Absalom. We're coming to it. And what this is then, this final stage, is Absalom burns Joab's field to get his attention. You think he's got his dad's attention, but he doesn't really. There has been bitterness that's grown up in Absalom's heart that's not dealt with. And now we're going to get, in the next few weeks, Absalom gets in the car. He gets in his Trans Am. He gets a few drinks. He floorboards it. And he gets some peers with him who he wants to impress. And he goes out and he kills himself. Absalom did the counterpart to that. You'll see it. His Trans Am, his drink, his death. It's the same thing. Total social maladjustment because of the root of bitterness that started back here that grew and grew and grew. Parents, let's ask God to give us wisdom to handle the importance of submission to God's authority with biblical instruction. Let's pray. Father, may this truth now be taught to us by your Holy Spirit, that some of our own young people who've heard tonight will be kept from destroying themselves. because they will obey their father and mother, as you promised, that their days may be long on the earth. Father, that we parents might have the foresight